Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, farmers in Central California are lining up for food. But first, in Afghanistan, a Taliban suicide bombing east of Kabul today killed some 24 people, including the country's deputy chief of intelligence. With U.S. deaths in Afghanistan in August reaching an all-time monthly high, some senior military officials say the Taliban's new strategy is taking Washington by surprise. They've told Washington Post correspondent Karen DeYoung that for the moment, the Taliban appears to be winning. And Karen joins us from Washington, D.C. Karen, you and your colleagues spoke with about a dozen military officials, and what are they telling you about the Taliban?
The Taliban, as they say, they've learned a lot. They've been in this battle for a long time. They have adapted. They have gotten better training. They are able to, in some places at least, certainly in eastern Afghanistan in particular, do complex attacks where they plot out the way an operation is going to go, where they're going to drive the enemy in their view, and essentially made things much more difficult for the Americans. In southern Afghanistan, the story is a little bit different, although equally as lethal. They have pulled back from doing these kind of mass attacks that they did in the past in small units, hit and run, a lot of IEDs, roadside bombs, and that's where most of the casualties are coming from there.
Mm-hmm. So basically, there's a different strategy in terms of their fighting. What does it mean? Does it mean you think that they're winning, really, or they think they're winning?
They believe that they're winning, which gives them a kind of extra boost and gives them the kind of forward motion, the momentum that each side is always looking for in this kind of battle.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the backdrop to all of this is the report from General Stanley McChrystal, which was given to the Obama administration this week about a potential strategy in Afghanistan, and the U.S. is weighing that. How do attacks like the one today that killed the deputy intelligence minister and these sort of comments that the Taliban may be increasing in power, how do you think they might play into the White House consideration of that report from General McChrystal?
Well, I think this report is General McChrystal saying, look, I've been here 2.5 months. This is what I see on the ground. This is what I think we're going to need in order to turn the tide here, and asking the president essentially to approve a strategy. And then if President Obama agrees with that strategy, then General McChrystal comes back and says, okay, this is what it will take to implement it. This is how many troops, this is how much resources in terms of money and manpower.
And also, aside from what might be happening with the Taliban, there's also the election results, which are still being looked at. And there are, about 2,600, I heard, formal complaints now of serious fraud alleged at the ballot box in Afghanistan. At this point, the latest results we got yesterday show Hamid Karzai, the incumbent, ahead of his main challenger, Abdullah. So how do these charges of election fraud and what might be happening there and the counting of the ballots all play into this as well?
I think this is very worrisome for U.S. strategy. It's going to be many, many weeks before there is any resolution, if ever, to this situation, and call it really into question whether this was a legitimate election or not. If the United States does not have a legitimately recognized government to deal with that Washington doesn't recognize as legitimate, let alone the Afghan people, then I think they have real problems in implementing whatever strategy they end up with, because it very much depends on having a legitimate Afghan government as a partner.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question about some of the folks that you interviewed, the U.S. and European military officials that you interviewed for this article. Karen, their names aren't used. Why is that?
Well, because I think that these are things that once you say something on the record, then you are held to it by your superiors and the people underneath you. And, you know, our choice is always, well, do we believe the information and have we triangulated enough? Have we talked to enough people? Or do we say no names, no reporting?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Washington Post correspondent Karen DeYoung talking with us about the military reaction to the apparent increasing sophistication of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Karen, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
In California, firefighters say today is a good day. They've gained ground against a massive wildfire north of Los Angeles thanks to lower temperatures and less wind. Evacuation orders have been lifted in some areas, but thousands of people are still out of their homes. The fire has scorched almost 200 square miles, and officials say this blaze largely has been driven by a three-year drought. The dry conditions are causing another set of problems further north in California's fertile Central Valley. And the farmers there say the drought is even worse because of a fight over fish, a tiny fish called the Delta smelt. Environmental regulations designed to protect the smelt impose restrictions on the water pumped to the region. Farmers are getting about one-tenth of their normal supply, so they're planting less, and farm workers are picking less. And unemployment in the city of Mendota, known as the cantaloupe capital of the world, is now at about 40%. Ironically, many former farm workers are now waiting in long lines for food. Joining us, Sir Joseph Riofrio. He's a city councilor and former mayor of Mendota, which is near Fresno. He also owns the West Side Grocery, which has been in his family for three generations, and he joins us from the store. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay. Also with us is Bill Dietrich. He's a farmer in the nearby town of Firebaugh. He owns two ranches where he plants almonds, prunes, and peaches. He also owns a pesticide spraying company. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, how are you?
Okay. Well, I'd like to ask both of you to explain exactly what's happening there with the water and the farming. Joseph, let's start with you. How bad is it?
My son is in high school. He's 14. I don't want him to even have to experience what I'm going through, which is having a business, personally speaking, that is losing money, going backwards. Mendota, Cantaloupe Center of the World, in the most agriculturally abundant county in the world. Billion-dollar industry, no different than the auto industry that is very vital and very necessary, agriculture. You know, when people in the East Coast and Boston go into a Costco or into a market and pick up a melon or some broccoli or the jeans they're wearing, that cotton, it's coming from here. It's coming from over here. And everything, the people that work in the fields, the people that drive trucks, people that work in packing houses, the farmers, that are four-generation, five-generation farmers like Mr. Dietrich, are suffering immensely. We're losing our livelihoods. The communities are reduced to communities that are dependent on food lines that are happening almost weekly here. People that would never, ever think of being in a food line are in food lines waiting for that food. And if people aren't going to be getting that weekly paycheck, aren't going to be able to pay the rent or keep enough milk in the house, I mean, that's really how desperate it is out here. The farmers and the farm workers are joining hand in hand. We're marching together to ask for help. This is unprecedented.
And Bill, what are you getting in terms of water, and what have you had to do in response because of that?
We have a very unique situation in this area where we have some of the deepest soils in the world, and all we need is water. Unfortunately, this area doesn't have an abundance of groundwater, so we are dependent upon surface water supplies. The water that we've got this year on our contract with the Bureau of Reclamation started out at zero. The last year we got 100% of our contract supply was in 2006. The 2006 was a very wet year. It was a good water year. But what growers have had to do is growers have had to set aside in fallow land that they normally plant. The other things that growers have to do is they have to go out on the open market and try and purchase surface water, and that gets extremely expensive, and it will get to the point where they will no longer be able to afford to buy that water, and that's going to further destroy the economic engine of the area.
We heard stories of things like folks pulling trees out of their property to conserve and things like that. Are you hearing about those things happening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's been some almond crops that have been barely irrigated enough to get the crop off this year, and they're being allowed to go. There's been some trees that weren't irrigated at all this year that were allowed to dry up and die, and they simply bulldozed those trees out.
And also, Bill, also whole acres and acres of tomato fields and other crops also, not just those orchards.
Well, every crop you can imagine, broccoli, right. Sweet corn, tomatoes, garlic, onions, you name it. You think of a crop in melons, my goodness, how the acres and acres of melons that usually are planted out here that were not planted this year.
Yes, that's absolutely right. People are coming in and, you know, complaining that they're working 5 and 6 hours, 3 and 4 days a week. It's not a typical 8 to 10 hour, even 11 hour, 6 day a week situation like it used to be out here, which enabled people to live and, you know, pay their rent and live comfortable lives out here and contribute greatly out here to what really is a nice, beautiful place to live, this part of California.
And we should say, Joseph, in Mendota, 95% of the population is immigrant farmer, isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. That is true. I think Mendota and Fireball in this area is absolutely the hardest working people in the country. And we're, you know, good, productive citizens, and, you know, we deserve some help, a little, and by help I mean water, something that the federal government is going to hear and say that you know the people out here mean something. You know,
we don't want to see this couched as a fish against farmers, because that's not the case. The science that was used to determine the operating procedures for the export pumps in the Delta, we believe, is flawed. And we intend to prove that in a court of law. The stressors that are truly affecting the populations of fish and the environmental degradation in the Delta, we do not believe have been addressed. The export pumps, you could turn them off tomorrow, and the Delta would not improve.
Well, let's explain that a little bit. There is a natural drought going on in California, and Governor Schwarzenegger did declare a water emergency just a couple of months ago.
Let me give you some facts that will frame that a little bit.
Okay.
In 1977, 76-77 was the driest year on record. And that year, there was 17 inches of rainfall at Shasta Dam. The federal CVP contractors, Central Valley Project, that's a Bureau of Reclamation, mm-hmm. that is where we get our surface water, that's our contract, ended up getting a 25% allocation that year. This year, we have had 55 inches of rainfall at Shasta Dam, and the federal CVB contractors started out with zero and eventually got 10%. So when you put it in that framework, you can see that there's something else going on. Yes, we've had 3 years of below average rainfall, but in 2008-09 precipitation year, we have had very close to normal rainfall. And when you say the word drought in California, there have been historically some very severe droughts. This 3 years doesn't really measure up historically as a severe drought. The problem are the restrictions on the pumping, on exporting water in the Delta.
That's Bill Dietrich, a California farmer. We're also speaking with Joseph Riofrio, a city councilor and grocer in Mendota, California. They'll be back with us in a minute. Coming up later in the show, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez travels abroad looking for support. Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about how the lack of water is making life difficult in the cantaloupe capital of the world, Mendota, California. Some farmers there say they are an endangered species, largely because of water restrictions designed to protect the small fish, the Delta smelt. The farmers say the restrictions could cost them almost $1.6 billion in revenue this year. It's also prompting some to propose secession, and local talk radio hosts such as Ray Appleton have been taking up the cause.
The farming is over. In the breadbasket of America that supplies more than a third of the country with food, because of a fish that's not even on the endangered species list.
At this point, federal officials are reconsidering their decision not to declare Fresno County a disaster area so that food shipments can get to unemployed farmers. Joining us are former mayor, city councilor, and Mendota grocery store owner Joseph Riofrio and farmer Bill Dietrich. And Joe, can you explain how farmers and farm workers are either divided or unified on this issue? I know you mentioned that they're marching together to Sacramento.
Yes, farm workers and farmers side by side. However, Bill, where's the UFW in this?
Well, that's the problem.
That's the Union of Farm Workers,
yes,
is that right?
Right, mm-hmm. United Farm Workers mm-hmm. Union. Many have said that UFW, for instance, receives money from environmentalists and other groups that support, you know, the endangered species. And, you know, that might be the case because we haven't, there has not been any presence whatsoever.
Well, you know, it's something interesting, though. Bill mentioned that he said this is not a fish versus farm issue. And I think that the environmentalists, some of them are saying that as well. And they're actually saying that this water issue is being almost pegged on the environmental decisions as a way to overturn these environmental rulings.
No, I mean, there is, you know, an us against them kind of a situation going on. You know, it'd be a lot better for everybody if everybody came to the table. You know, those people that are saying these things, that this is a natural desert and let it become a desert and let the people relocate and we'll buy foreign food, that way of thinking is going to kill a lot of people's lives out here.
Hmm.
That's not an option.
Yeah, you know, this has gotten some, there's certainly like right-wing talk radio saying a lot of things against government, against environmentalists. There's a group saying that some farmers in Central California should secede from the state. It seems to be gaining ground, too, because of this whole water issue. What would be the best way to try to resolve this in the short term as is needed, as you say, Joe?
Well, I think people like Mr. Dietrich and others on the other side, on the environmentalist side, our elected officials need to call a huge water summit out here, and not just the state. I'm talking the feds also. Get them out here. Get the president involved, the same way he got involved with the auto industry. And you know, California, known as a soft liberal state that grasps mainly environmental causes, that's hurting the state as a whole. You know, people need to look outside of their little circle, their environmental circle or whatever it is, and look around at the state as a whole, what it is, what's California's claim to fame. You know, it's agriculture.
And Bill, what do you think should be done?
Well, there's many processes that are underway as we speak, legal challenges, and then we need to have federal pressure and we need to have state pressure from our representatives to move the process forward. And the problem is that two-thirds of our water is in the north state, two-thirds of our population is in the south state. So something has to be done to move water south. And the system we have right now is broken, not only physically broken, but it's risky because of the levee system we have in the deltas and because of the way we're exporting water. It needs to be changed. So let's make those changes in a timely fashion so that the state can continue to prosper.
Hmm.
And that seems very simple, but when you have as many stakeholders in the state and everyone is beating their drum and putting out their propaganda, it's a very emotional issue, and it's difficult to overcome emotion with facts. Very difficult.
Hmm. Has this problem affected prices of the types of produce that you've been talking about, Bill?
I can't speak to that, but I do know that we've got thousands and thousands of acres that's laid fallow, some of the most precious cauliflower, broccoli, melons, sweet corn in the world, and it's not being grown. So I would imagine that, yes, it has. It has to have affected the prices.
And cantaloupes are still being grown.
There are some cantaloupes still being grown because mm-hmm. Regionally there are some different areas that are not under the same dire restrictions on water, and they have better and more secure water rights
And Joseph, you mentioned at the beginning that you you don't want your 14-year-old son to take over the family business because you don't want him to experience what you've been experiencing. What are you encouraging him to do?
Of course, to do well in high school, go to college, and to do something a little more normal than be self-employed. He sees me in here, and I ask him, is this what you want to do? He sees me, says, absolutely not. And I says, you know what you've got to do, son, because it's not the same anymore. You know, we're talking about all these complicated issues pertaining to water, and it boils down to survival. And these small communities are not surviving. And it's that in the midst of all the politics and differences of opinions, the end result is that we're dependent on these weekly food giveaways, and it's just a terrible situation all the way around. And that's why I say we can't endure another year of it. Something has to happen. Something has to happen really quick.
Joseph Riofrio is a city councilor in Mendota, California. He's also owner of the West Side Grocery. Joseph, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Bill Dietrich is a farmer in Firebaugh, California. He also owns a pesticide spraying company. Bill, thanks very much, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Are you among those who pride themselves on being able to multitask, say, talk, text, email, listen to the radio simultaneously? Well, you may not be as good at multitasking as you think. A new study says those who multitask the most are actually the worst at it. Eyal Ophir is lead author of that study, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He's also a researcher at Stanford University's Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. And Eyal, you looked at what you call media multitasking, which is how often people use different forms of media at the same time. What did you find?
We found that those people that multitask very heavily with media are actually less able to block out distractions. They're less able to block out irrelevant thoughts in their mind. And most surprisingly, they're worse at switching back and forth between tasks because they can't help thinking about the task they're not doing.
Your study is based on 250 or so college undergraduates, and you basically put them through a set of experiments. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. For example, one time we were giving them a task with red rectangles, and they had to pay attention to the red rectangles and see if they changed orientation. And we told them to completely ignore the blue rectangles, which were also present. Now, people that don't multitask very much were very good at this. It didn't matter how many blue rectangles were in the background. They never paid attention to them, and it didn't matter if they were present or not present. They performed just as well. The heavy media multitaskers, on the other hand, as soon as you started adding more and more blue rectangles, their performance was worse because they couldn't help paying attention to those rectangles, even though they were entirely irrelevant.
I guess the big question when I first heard this is if a serial multitasker, if you know, for lack of a better term here, is
sure,
actually worse at multitasking than a less multitasked peer, then why would this serial multitasker be multitasking so much?
Those people that don't multitask much are very good at deciding where their attention will go, and they can choose that their attention will go to one thing and focus on that and block out all the distractions. Those that multitask more heavily, on the other hand, are less in control of their own attention, but you can think of it as being more responsive to their environment. So anything in the environment catches their attention, and as a result, they're more distractible. Now, I'm sure there are environments where one or the other is more fitting, and so it's difficult to say just across the board what's better, what's worse, without really knowing what kind of activities they're trying to engage in.
Were there certain areas that perhaps the folks who were more prone to multitasking might be an advantage for them?
Well, I mean, this is clearly an area of speculation, but it's very exciting speculation, and this is where we're trying to move forward with our research. So if you think, for example, one of the hottest areas of multitasking is the car. For example, talking on the phone while driving, which has been shown to be extremely dangerous. And so you can think of it in either way. If you think about those people that don't multitask, maybe they're very good at focusing, but maybe in this situation they'd be very good at focusing on the conversation, and they would be less likely to have their attention pulled away by something that suddenly happens on the road, let's say somebody braking in front of them, whereas the multitaskers might be better at that. On the other hand, multitaskers, while they're driving, are more likely to be distracted by the person next to them or by the phone or by the radio. So we're trying to answer precisely those questions, but you could certainly understandably see how one or the other might be beneficial.
Were you surprised by the results of this?
We were extremely surprised. We were certain that we would find some kind of ability on the part of multitaskers. Maybe they had greater memory, so they'd be able to store more things, or maybe they'd just be better at switching quickly back and forth. We were looking for that special ability that's allowing them to do something that's so difficult. And in terms of cognitive control, what we actually found was a deficit. And especially when it comes to task switching, humans don't really parallel process. So we don't really think of two things at once. What we do is we switch very quickly back and forth. And so task switching is really at the root of multitasking. And it was certainly shocking to see that this ability that's so fundamental to multitasking is something heavy multitaskers actually don't do as well.
Are you a multitasker?
I am not, actually. Funnily enough, my wife knows that when my attention is grabbed to something, I can't hear anything, I can't see anything. So I'm definitely a one thing at a time kind of person.
All right. Well, Eyal Ophir is a researcher at Stanford's Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. He's the lead author of a new study on multitasking. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, if you're a multitasker and can listen to the radio and send us an email at the same time, we'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us or call us at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and his travels abroad. It's Here and Now. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is on a whirlwind tour, visiting some potential allies who share his view of the United States. He's been in Africa this week, where he helped celebrate Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi's 40th anniversary in power. Additional stops on his itinerary include Syria, Iran, and Russia. Joining us to explain what Hugo Chavez is up to abroad and what he's facing at home is Doug Farah. He's an author and former reporter who lived in and covered Latin America during the 80s and 90s, and he's now a senior fellow at the International Assessment and Strategy Center in Washington, D.C. And Doug, what's your take on Chavez's international trip?
Well, whenever Chavez gets in trouble at home or when his popularity dips and he's having oil revenue difficulties, etc., he goes abroad to show that his Bolivarian revolution, which he calls socialism for the 21st century, is popular outside and that he can still draw an audience. But primarily it is aimed at angering the United States and sticking his finger in the U.S. eye, which worked very effectively with the Bush administration, and the Obama administration so far has taken sort of a more hands-off approach with him.
So let's talk about some of those issues at home. Why is his popularity dipping?
Well, there's been ample evidence revealed through a series of computers that were captured last year that he's been very actively supporting the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, which is one of the world's premier drug trafficking organizations. And its main tactic for raising money outside of drug trafficking is to kidnap people. And it's become a very disdained international organization. It's gone from its Marxist roots as an insurgency to a criminal organization. And he's been supporting them very actively, and that's now amply clear. Oil prices are down, so he's running a huge budget deficit. His inflation rate will be around 27% this year. And he's unable to control the violence in his country. Venezuela now has an average of almost 40 homicides per 100,000, which puts it among the top countries in the world for violence. Mm-hmm. So all of these things make his time at home a little less fun, and it's more fun to go visit other folks.
He also thought that he was going to be instrumental in getting Honduras' former president, Zelaya, back in power after he was ousted in a coup. How much has his failure to do that affected Chavez?
Well, I think it's obviously made him quite irate. He initially promised to invade militarily to reestablish Zelaya. He has a few allies, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, President Correa in Ecuador, Evo Morales in Bolivia, but the rest of the continent did not really mobilize behind him as he wanted to, and I think Chavez sees this as a setback and also as a bad omen for the future of the Bolivarian Revolution. If one can fall, then perhaps others can fall.
And then, of course, speaking of Colombia, that was a major topic of discussion in last month's South American summit, and that was the agreement between Colombia and the United States over several military bases in Colombia and U.S. access to military bases in Colombia. What prompted that move, and how did Chavez receive it?
Well, the thing that prompted the move for the United States to do that was that Chavez's ally, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, had shut down or allowed the lease to lapse on a major Air Force base in Ecuador, in Manta. And that was where the Drug Enforcement Administration in the U.S. different agencies could monitor the cocaine trafficking across the Pacific route, which is one of the primary routes that cocaine transits to get to Mexico and then to the United States. And with the loss of that base, the United States was looking for another place to establish a setting where they could monitor the Pacific traffic, and they asked Colombia, which is a very close ally of the United States, if they could have access to a number of Colombian bases. The United States, under current agreements, can have up to 800 troops in Colombia, advisors in the counter-drug war, but they only have about 300, and that may grow a little bit. It'll certainly stay way below the 800 limit that already exists. But it's given Chavez a tremendous platform to talk about the Yankee aggression, the Yankee plans for coming in and destroying the region, and given the history of Latin America, that has some resonance, and Chavez has managed to play to that very well.
Let's talk about this current international tour of his and a visit to Russia. You've written that Chavez has offered Russia an island where it could place strategic long-range missile bases. What's going on there?
Well, again, I think it's purely, from Chavez's point of view, a way to antagonize the United States and make people nervous. The Russians are very happy because they're trying very hard to re-engage in the international arms market. Chavez has bought about $4.5 billion worth of weapons from Russia in the last 3 years, and he's gotten a $100 million line of credit for the Bolivians to also start buying weapons. Ecuador is starting to buy weapons there. So the Russians are very happy with this. And Chavez was, prior to the Colombians offering to host the American bases, was talking about allowing the Russians there for unlimited access to actually have a base on an island in the Caribbean just off the coast of Venezuela. That sort of blew up in his face, too. That caused a lot of internal reaction, and he's since said that, well, maybe it wouldn't be such a good idea, but the Russians are welcome whenever they want, which puts him in a rather awkward position criticizing other countries for allowing foreign military presence.
Right. And a lot has been mentioned about Hugo Chavez's relationship with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. What about that relationship? Is that, again, another way of getting at the U.S., or is there something more substantive there?
Well, I think it's one of the more curious and really interesting relationships, because a progressive socialist revolution has very little in common, either theologically, philosophically, or in any other way, with a reactionary theocracy of Shia Muslims. And so there's nothing in common except a hatred for the United States. But Ahmadinejad and Chavez have a very warm personal relationship. This, I believe, is Chavez's 8th trip to Iran. Ahmadinejad has visited Venezuela at least 4 times. This is since 2005. So they really like each other, and I think they view themselves as constructing an alternate power center to the United States that will be able to operate outside the traditional, you know, Western imposition of power or hegemony. And I think they both really like this idea. Unfortunately, the way the oil prices have gone in the last 18 months or so have really crimped their ability to deliver on the multiple promises of aid they've made to each other and to other countries around the region in an effort to get them to join this revolution.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is an historically unstable region that we're talking about here. A lot of violent drug wars, complicated alliances. How would you describe the level of stability in the region?
Well, I think you're seeing the growth of the drug cartels in Mexico particularly being a challenge. As you see the rise of gangs and organized crime across Central America, you have another challenge to the state's ability to govern in those regions, particularly Guatemala. The war in Colombia is going very well against the FARC and other sort of structured groups, but the level of violence remains tremendously high and the amount of drug trafficking remains the same. So I think that all of these pose challenges to the governance of the region in ways that are really shocking, because you're talking about billions and billions of dollars in organized crime money coming into structures that directly challenge the state and the states that are historically weak and inept and corrupt. And I think that in the short term, we're facing very serious challenges there.
All right. Doug Farah, author, former reporter in Latin America, and senior researcher at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Doug, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the time.
Out on DVD this week is the Spanish-language movie that brought its 30-something writer-director much acclaim this year. Cary Fukunaga's Sin Nombre, Spanish for Without a Name, begins with the brutal initiation of a 12-year-old boy into the Mexican gang Mara 13. The film then takes us into a world where thousands of illegal immigrants from Central America ride on top of trains to get through Mexico to the U.S., Syra, a young girl from Honduras, is among them. As she tells her fellow traveler, Willie, she always knew she would go to America, though a psychic told Syra that it would not be in the hands of God, but in the hands of a devil.
Luego fui con mi amiga Clarisa a casa de mi vecina, la vieja loca que se llamaba Doña Leonor. Era bruja. bajé. Me dijo con voz de miedo. Vas a llegar a los Estados Unidos. Pero no de la mano de Dios, sino de la garra del diablo.
Willie might not be the devil, but he's definitely dangerous. He's a former member of the Mara 13 gang, and he's fleeing death threats from his former comrades. And that's just one of the dangers facing Willie and Syrah. Sean Nombre won cinematography and director's awards at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's writer-director Cary Fukunaga's first feature-length film, and we thought we'd revisit a conversation that Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa had with Fukunaga this year. He began by saying that his own multi-ethnic background, part Swedish, part Japanese-American, was not what drew him to this story.
It wasn't necessarily that I was searching for an immigrant story or that it related necessarily to my past. It was more visceral imagery that I felt was important to make and that I had the opportunity to make. Will I continue to make films about immigration? Probably not.
You talked about it at the screening last night. You sort of threw yourself into doing an awful lot of research. Can you talk about that a little?
Not being Central American, not being Mexican, I think for me to make this film and not only to legitimize the story I was telling, but also just in the effort to be as authentic as possible, it was important that I see and experience as much as possible.
You went into prisons and you talked to gang members about their lives.
I did. I spent a lot of time in prisons meeting with members of both 18th Street and Mara 13. In particular, I was studying the 13th Street gang because they are the ones that controlled the territories around where the immigrants gathered and traveled. I also rode the trains and for me, it was necessary to see with my own eyes this trip.
Well, I have to ask you because, you know, you portray it very vividly. So can you talk a little bit about how it felt to ride on top of a train?
That first night I got on the train, and there was something very peaceful and quiet about it because we left very late. We left around 2:30 in the morning. There was lightning way in the distance, but there was no thunder, so it was just kind of like flashing on the horizon, and there were fireflies on the side of the train kind of lighting up the grass by the side of the train, and it was actually very beautiful, and I was kind of ecstatic for a moment. There was this, something very sort of like a Nirvana-esque sort of feeling about it. And then the train stopped in this area. I don't know where we were, about 2 hours outside of Tapachula. Everything was quiet, and then out of nowhere, there was three extremely loud gunshots about a train car away, and everyone started screaming and jumping off the train and running this way and that way. I was with about 8 or 9 Guatemalan immigrants, and we stayed put because we were afraid that if we got down, it'd be too hard to get back up on the same train car, and there was a danger of falling into the train. So we stayed put and just waited to see if they would attack us. And nothing happened, and then the train started taking off, and people started jumping back on the train. And I didn't find out till the next day when we were just kind of stopped. I met some immigrants outside the train that I met the night before, and they told me they were right there, and that a Guatemalan immigrant didn't want to give his money to some bandits, and so they shot him and threw him off the train. And I asked if the bandits were still on the train, and they didn't know because they ran. And so here I was about to go into another night on this train, not knowing if there were still bandits on board. But that sort of fear of not knowing what's going to happen to you next is something that the immigrants who are traveling live with every day. The second time I rode the train, I rode with another group of Guatemalans across Veracruz. And one of the things they talked about when I asked them if they were afraid of anything happening was that, one, they're in the hands of God. But if you didn't believe that, then at least think positively and nothing will happen. Meaning that as long as you say nothing's going to happen, nothing will happen. And if something happens, well, you didn't think hard enough.
I just want to go back to the gang thing because what's very interesting is you talked about the screening as well, how important it was that you didn't sort of portray gangs and just, you know, in a particular light the way they've been portrayed in the media. And one thing that came through very clearly are these flashes of affection, camaraderie, which actually in some ways made the violence even harder to take when it happens.
You know, the gang stuff, I was wary about continuing sort of like cliches of the gang. But in some ways, the gang lives up to its own cliches. People become this sort of like this version of themselves again based on media, you know, perception. And in this particular story in this town, I just wanted to portray it as I had learned about it to be, and nothing beyond that. The locations are real. The cemetery is a real place where the gang used to meet. It's all kind of based on realities, but it's a collage, if you will, of stories that I learned over the 2 years with the gang and then sometime on the street with them also.
I probably have to talk just a little bit about your actors, because what is interesting to me is the fact that you have such a combination of very experienced, not experienced at all, in your two leads.
Edgar Flores, who plays Willie, is a first-time actor. He's never been in a film before. And Paulina Gaitan, who plays Syra, has been acting since she was 9 years old, and so she knew about having her own trailer and, you know, hair and makeup, whereas Edgar was really moving from a ghetto in Tegus to a studio production in Mexico and having his own one-bedroom apartment larger than his house that he lived in with his father and stepmother and other family members. And you would think he'd be ecstatic, but I think he was actually quite depressed as well by this change and not sure how to handle the pressure and not sure if he could do what I was asking him to do as playing this role. But I think that maybe that intensity also of the new experience was translated on the screen as well, because there is a tired intensity that we needed from this character, a weariness, and I think that comes across on screen. I think you see it in his face, especially after the journey. In a way, I think even making the film, he was living that journey.
Ay, Dios, cómo la regó esta madre. Yo no puedo cuidarte, ¿no?
No, si no te lo estoy pidiendo, Mike.
Pero el amor de Dios, Aira, di cuenta que yo ya estoy muerto. Que no agarras color.
I wanted to ask one thing about, I mean, obviously you don't want to just tell immigrant experiences, but I'm just curious because it feels like, you know, having a very multi-ethnic background, it seems like it would give you just sort of a perspective of not quite one or the other, just like a lot of them all together.
Yeah, you don't necessarily belong to one tribe or the other. I'm not white and I'm not Asian, but you get the feeling like you can adapt and move in and out of tribes. It's more like you're always independent, almost like a loner. And I think that's definitely translated into how I explore the world. I like to be like a chameleon and go into places and learn the language as best I can and really just kind of blending in. But then just as easily be able to pull out and go into another culture or another environment. That's definitely how I live my life.